Welcome to Stout Audio, produced at Spruce Knob Studios in Middletown Springs, Vermont. Stout brings you stories and ideas about the things you've seen a thousand times but never really looked at. Welcome to the show. Here's your host, Herb Childress. Welcome back to Stout Audio. For this week's story, I thought I'd go back into the storeroom and bring out an old nonfiction short that I wrote as an exercise while I was getting ready for my first novel, The Abbot of Saginaw. Abbot was set in 1956 in a pool room in Saginaw, Michigan, and I knew that the physical world of the Genesee Billiards Club would be as much a character in this story as Robert or Charles or Bess. So I went through the pool rooms that I'd spent time in, thinking about the characteristics that made them into the places that they were, and made us into the people we were there, in order to help me be able to live in the pool room that had come to my imagination. It was never intended to be published, and wasn't part of the novel. But it was necessary work, and I'll share it with you. This week's nonfiction short is called Six Rooms. Imagine a strip mall, the stores anchored by a massive Kroger supermarket, but then quickly running down the scale of desperation. Joann Fabrics, a Chinese restaurant, H&R Block, a dry cleaner, a never-open computer repair store. A pool room run by two Iranian brothers lies somewhere on that continuum. The slim brother grips the table with his left hand as he drags his polio-bent legs from one shot to the next, but once he bends down to his work, he is as sure as any athlete. He collects $20 bills from his opponents, one every 10 or 15 minutes. But between games, while he labors to haul crates of empty beer bottles to the storeroom, he has a few minutes to give pointers to an awkward novice with a bargain cue and vague aspirations. The thicker brother is always on his cell phone, standing behind the bar, making some sort of negotiation or another, sometimes in English and sometimes not. He never works, and he rarely plays, but he does carry a chromed semi-automatic tucked in his belt under his t-shirt in the small of his back, and isn't too concerned about who sees it. No one knows their birth names. They used Americanized analogs. The slim, crippled player is Oscar. The stocky, secretive phone man is Ned. One table closest to the bar register is framed by a low counter dividing the playing area from the walkway. That's the money table, Oscar's workplace. They've changed the cloth twice this year already, and the balls are cleaned hourly. The other 11 tables are for recreation. Solid enough, but with worn cloth and lower grade ball sets. The room has been open for about 3 years. The carpet still flat and not yet paced through. The storefront windows, installed for hundreds of feet of strip mall facade as a generically desirable feature for retailers to show off their goods, are shielded here by cafe curtains and darkened with low-priced tint film. The gloom within is punctuated by illuminated beer signs and four small televisions arrayed along the top of the bar back, each set to a different, unwatched station. The only good players are on the show table. The rest are languid, dull, inattentive. They believe that they are practicing or competing, but there is no rigor. All are men. There are no women players so delusional, and this is not a date night destination. A slow tide of players washes in and out, occasionally flooding the room with unwanted light as the door opens. None are individually notable or accounted for. Imagine an exurban highway, two lanes in each direction divided by segmented concrete crash barriers. The 50-mile-an-hour speed limit presents its own hazards as drivers make sudden stops to enter a gas station or coffee shop parking lot, or attempt to emerge from those oases and get immediately up to speed. With 4 miles or more between opportunities to reverse direction, the divided road has nurtured a pair of mirrored ecosystems, like continents divided by tectonic drift. There's a Dunkin' Donuts on the northbound side, directly across from the Dunkin' Donuts on the southbound side. They could share a subterranean kitchen. There are struggling Chinese and Vietnamese restaurants on each side, gas stations on each side, a strip club on each side, abandoned cars and abandoned buildings and vacant lots on each side. In one of those shambling, low-rent slabs, behind the porn store and below the Japanese restaurant, and next to the vacant three-story glass office building that had once seemed like a good idea to some dot-com speculator, there is an unmarked door, the kind of place that one knocks four times and asks for Louis. Hidden inside, a pool room blossoms like a mushroom from a rotting log. The cloth hasn't been changed on most tables for a couple of years, but the tables themselves are sound and well-tuned, their pockets slightly small, a true test. And, surprise of all surprises, there are three Soren Sogard carom billiard tables, electrically heated, always occupied. Those tables have new cloth. Two communities occupy this landscape in succession. Counterintuitively, the serious players are present in the afternoon. A small tribe, 20 or so men in their 50s and older, observe interlopers from behind an impenetrable barrier of shared knowledge and taciturn resistance. They exchange language only under duress, American Gothic with a Q instead of a pitchfork. They play with skill and care, spending almost every afternoon barely acknowledging one another's presence as they move from one shot to the next. An occasional thump of the opponent's cue butt on the floor signals high praise, reminiscent of the beatniks who snapped their fingers in response to cool jazz and poetry. The players have left by the time the college kids and the once-a-week league bangers arrive at 7. The televisions, silent during the day, are all on. Beer sales go from a bottle an hour to 5 bottles a minute. The day players accounted for perhaps $150 of cumulative revenue from noon to 6. The night crowd matches that 3 times an hour until midnight. But it is the day players for whom this room exists. The others merely subsidize. Imagine a Manhattan deco-era apartment block near Broadway. Cabs choke the streets, bike couriers risk dismemberment to carry takeout orders through town. During the day, the sidewalks are filled with all ages, pushing babies in strollers or mysterious belongings in wheeled wire carts. At night, the sidewalks are just as dense, but the traffic is far younger and all gorgeous, each ready at any second to separate from her or his predatory pack and stalk equally sleek prey. The nightclub in the base of that apartment building is large and richly appointed, dark stained wood and brass rails and mirrors on the squared columns. 30 pool tables are spread throughout the huge room, each of which is cleaned and groomed daily. The counterman takes possession of credit cards and assigns tables, enters the start time and the number of players for each table by tapping a touchscreen on the register. The ball sets are Super Aramith TV Pro Cup, expensive, designed for televised tournaments. The televised illusion goes far beyond imagining oneself playing Ralph Souquet or Allison Fisher on ESPN. Cocktails are delivered tableside by fantastically beautiful girls, offering just enough attentiveness and cleavage to ensure good tipping, while making it clear that their minds are elsewhere. Strong players inhabit most of the perimeter tables, young and hard, surreptitiously eyeing new arrivals, alert to any challenge to their local superiority. The middle tables are NYU kids out to show themselves off. The more attractive, the closer to the center of the room they're placed, acting as the centerpieces of the party, viewable from all angles. The bar features top-shelf liquor and has a signature cocktail, the Naughty Suggestion. Miras vodka, crushed mint and basil, and the glass garnished with 2 roasted cocoa beans. The girls love to ask their boys for a naughty suggestion, and the boys are happy to spend $14 on each one, presuming adequate later return on investment. Some players are stronger than others. An average Saturday evening might see hundreds or thousands of dollars quietly change hands at one of the 2 tables inside the brass rail nearest the bar, as visiting professionals stop by to fulfill a match they'd set up via email. They're used to the TV Pro Cup balls, having been on TV many times themselves. The pretty ones observe from outside the tournament ring, less interested in the game itself than in the simmer of competition. Watching boys compete is what they're drawn to. Imagine an anonymous freestanding commercial building on a through street bordering an impoverished residential neighborhood in a small city. A struggling coffee shop, a rug merchant with a perpetual going-out-of-business poster in the window, a tattoo parlor, a bail bondsman, that kind of building, in that kind of neighborhood. The building's tenant for a dozen years has been a gregarious pool room with a gregarious owner. Mac sees everything, knows the names of everyone who've been there more than twice, hollers greetings across the room from wherever he happens to be. The plywood floor was last painted before Mac arrived. It has some spongy spots, a little extra bounce underfoot that warns of impending failure. Hasn't failed yet. The bar is tiny, with only a glass-doored refrigerator offering refreshment. Bottled beer, bottled water, bottled soda. It seems to suffice. Several hundred bottles of beer go through that hub every evening, a third of them Pabst Long Necks for $1.50. Cardboard boxes line the walls between the spectator chairs to receive the empties. Every table is taken, as are the card tables in the corners and the two tabletop video games at each end of the bar. The lights from the beer fridge are the brightest illumination in the room. The pool room is only blocks away from a spoiled kid college with a notable drinking problem, but the fraternities and sororities hold their binges closer to home, leaving Max to an older community. Most are in their 30s. A third or so are women. Half a dozen are black or Latino. The jukebox roars James Brown and Prince and is never left unfed. The tables were good long ago, but haven't been tuned for years. Several players are decent, but nobody comes to Max to play seriously. Mac himself is a strong player and occasionally amuses himself and others by winning a game while playing with a mop handle or an illuminated toy lightsaber. The lightsaber is only one manifestation of his Star Wars fandom. He often likens his room with great satisfaction to the intergalactic cantina scene, patrons of all description. Another assessment comes from a first-time visitor. This reminds me of a place I used to go when I lived in Eritrea. Max opens at 5 and closes more or less at 2. Almost everyone comes in on one calendar page and leaves on the next. Every night when the clock rounds the top and starts over, there are 80 or so moderately drunk patrons, but fights or even loud arguments are virtually unknown. The hard-living young barfly with the tight jeans and the tramp stamp. The car salesman soothing away another slow day at his showroom. The lesbian couple in work boots and flannel. The newly divorced professor avoiding his empty house. The dropout sampling a community college course now and then. Mac welcomes any mutt to his pack. Imagine a small machine shop, concrete block walls, huge rolling doors, and overhead craneways. Now imagine that shop gutted, converted to a fantasy biker man cave. Almost $2 million of decor, if such a fussy French word could be force-fit to neon gasoline signs and massive loops of shipyard chain, simultaneously updates and falsifies the shop's industrial origins. It is a pool hall, with 15 good tables, run by a former road player who's hung up his cues, but that identity is secondary to sports bar. The owner loves pool, but loves money more, and knows that pool and money fit poorly together. No matter how slightly one might turn, one of the 42 televisions will be in the line of sight. College basketball, stock car racing, rodeo, bass fishing, monster truck rallies. All sports, all the time, but no pool. A different kind of pretty girl works as a waitress here, big-haired, big-breasted, often tattooed, working her way through cosmetology school. There seems to be a mandatory retirement age at 25. Coors Light has provided them all with black jerseys, two sizes too small, and they walk with their chests forward like pigeons. There are no men working in public view here, only pigeon girls, serving hot wings and cold beer and plenty of sass. This room holds two professional tournaments a year. The owner acts as a patron of his former art, adding a few $1,000s to the prize pool. On tournament weekends, the televisions over the tables are dark. The ever-blaring Lynyrd Skynyrd and Guns N' Roses soundtrack is muted. The walls are lined with cue cases, over 100 propped against every vertical surface, while the handful of bored wives and girlfriends pick up the conversations and grievances they'd had at the last tournament a month back in a different town. This room's own house pro is the same age as the Pigeon Girls, but just elected to the U.S. team for international play. Last year, he made about $28,000 in tournament winnings. He currently stands among the 20 best players in the world, earning, after travel expenses, less than a call center technician or a convenience store cashier. Imagine an urban residential neighborhood, two-family houses side by side with walk-up apartment blocks, transient college kids and Italian families of three generations all on the same block. In that block, a tired brick building, a bowling alley, one of those tiny 12-laners from the 1930s that faded when the suburban megacenters arrived. This one only exists because the building's been paid for since 1962. It doesn't make enough money to cover overhead and pay rent. The building has one large room and one smaller room. The bowling alley is the larger. The 8-table pool room is the smaller. The control counter straddles them, the logistical and social center. Everybody who works the counter has some sharp humor ready for every customer, known and unknown. A small crowd puddles around that hub all evening, with no libations stronger than what could be had from the drinking fountain or the Pepsi machine. The pool room has no overall lighting, but rather has a pair of fluorescent tubes running side by side above the length of each table, only turned on when the table is in use. This helps focus concentration on the table itself, an island of illumination in a larger pool of gloom. During the day, with one or two people practicing, the only sounds are the click of ball against ball and the clunk of ball into pocket, temple bells monastic in their purity. The floor is carpeted, indoor-outdoor carpet that hasn't been changed since the Nixon administration, but which holds the noise down a bit. The walls are a deeply ridged beadboard, painted a dark leather red. A rough line of blue chalk dust highlights that red at about 4.5 feet up, marking generations of cues leaned momentarily against the wall while their players took a leak or went outside for a smoke. The owners, now the fourth and soon to be final generation of the family to manage it, are not afraid of spending money to counter the neighborhood's ambient temperature. Walk in from the February snow and plunge into an immediate 75-degree pool of defrost. In August, when it's 93 degrees and sticky, the huge 1950s air conditioner, 8 feet tall and 5 feet wide and looking like a gargantuan old refrigerator, covered with band stickers, blows a torrent of dry 55-degree air across table one like a great, blessed river of cool. No matter what one's idea of a pool room might be, it is proven wrong by some of its specific cases. Pool halls are all dark and seedy, except for the ones that aren't. They're all men, except for the ones that aren't. They're infected with gambling and other iniquities, except for the ones that aren't. Pool is their reason for existence, except for when it isn't. I know many of them. I am a connoisseur of their differences, and seek out new flavors while still returning regularly to particular favorites. A couple of them have been home, temporarily, when home was otherwise unavailable. My own routine is invariable, regardless of what room I visit. I pick up a rack of balls at the counter, find my table, and put down my varied supplies. Cue case, sunglasses, cell phone, styrofoam teacup, and the rack of balls. I move deliberately. Unzip the cue case. Remove the butt of the playing cue. Unscrew its joint protector. Remove one of its two shafts. Take off its joint protector. Screw the two halves of the cue together and lay it on the table. Repeat the same procedure with the two halves of the brake queue, and lean it against the wall, adjacent to a coat hook so that it won't fall over. Put the joint protectors into the small case pocket and remove 3 cubes of chalk. Unzip the large case pocket and pull out a chocolate bar and a hand towel. Take the balls from the ball tray and scatter them 2 or 3 at a time around the table, leaving space between each. The ball tray, hand towel, chocolate, and tea all go onto the side table, and the cue case is propped in the corner. The whole affair takes 3 or 4 minutes, and reminds me of the sequence of taking off my shoes and bowing to the Korean flag when I took karate lessons in my childhood. A deliberate slowing of the mind, a call to attentiveness. A good pool room is akin to a dojo or a church, present and welcoming at the beginning and then utterly disappearing to liturgy and reverence. We arrive and are taken in once again, welcomed by fellow members of the congregation. We enter the sanctuary and are inspired anew by the architecture, the light filtering in through stained glass, the deep colors of the altar cloths, the thundering chords of Bach organ chorales. But as the service progresses, we lose our spatial awareness, lose ourselves, and become a mere enactor of a larger drama. I have not seen this room except in my imagination, but I have seen elements of it now and then, and I know that it could exist. That was 6 Rooms, a nonfiction short created as an exercise before setting down to write the novel, The Abbot of Saginaw. Nothing goes to waste for a writer. Thanks for listening, and I hope we'll see you back for another episode of Stout Audio.